Okay, let's go. We had never, that I know of, done this before, and we just had this idea that what if we did special units for specific works? And Rick and I are going to just share with you random ideas. I don't know what his ideas are. He doesn't know mine. And we're just going to share with you a thing that helped us in ministry along the way. We've learned some things, and we are pretty sure we got lots more to learn. So I'll share an idea. It may cause Rick to think of something in a totally different vein, and he's going to go with it. Then he'll share an idea, and if I don't have anything to add to it, I won't. And so that's what it's about, okay? But we highly admire you. And we ache for your ministries in areas that you ache in. So we think that music will quit here pretty quickly. And I'm just going to share with you some things that made a difference for my work. And if any of it is useful for you, great. I went to a school where they said, now look, try to stay somewhere 2 years. and if you can stay 2 years, you're doing okay. If you can stay three, that's good. If you can stay five, that's really good. Well, here's the deal on it. And they also had this tag. And so save all of your sermon outlines so that when you move to the next congregation, you'll have that much ahead. Well, I preached at a church of eight for a year. And then I moved to Quincy and preached there 2 years, then to Tulsa. So after in Tulsa for 2 years, I had saved every sermon. I kept saving up. And that was a very scary thing for me to think that the week is coming where there is no more information from God. None. I mean, I'm cut off. And so one day in my office, it was like a ritual of some sort. I went over to my filing cabinet and picked up this much of years of sermon notes and threw them in the trash. And every sermon now, it just goes in the trash, which the Brotherhood is highly grateful for. But anyway, I throw them away, and God has been there, so he has not missed a beat. Not only that, he's been there stronger than when I was saving them. And so I just want to encourage you that if you walk as I did in fear that he wouldn't have anything there for you to say, he will be there, and he's quick, and he's sharp, and he's waiting on us. And so that move really helped me.
Well, let me say first, too, I really admire you guys. We know how hard what we do is. I have never, ever gone anywhere and volunteered to teach preaching or preachers, because I'm learning. But Mississippi. Yeah, I'm sorry.
They're to have quit, but what we're going to do is, now we'll begin to hear, but it won't be long until we can't breathe. Then we'll get some air to breathe, and we won't be able to hear.
I've preached at two churches. I've preached at one for 11 years and one for 22. So I have had to learn how to stay fresh, and I do save some of my sermons. But Terry's right. I've been at one church now for 22 years, and the ideas for future sermons are so huge I can't contain them. I've got at least three more years of ideas for sermons percolating right now. I made my elders a promise when I came here 22 years ago. I will never stand in that pulpit and I haven't studied. I will never stand up and wing it. I will never stand up and say, well, I preached on this enough. I think I can. I never have. And I have found as long as I stay discipline in my time and my word, I have not run out of new things to say. So I hope that will be an encouragement to you, that God really will show up and give you something to say. So that was a good word.
Yeah. What's one of yours?
Well, what I'm going to do, I spent some time just thinking about this, and I wrote down 10 things I've learned and I'm still learning, and I'm going to leave this up here. I think I made about 40 copies, and so I don't know which one's the most important, but since I put this one first, this must have been the one that pressed on me the most. Here's the number one thing I've learned in ministry, that I have to minister from my blessing, instead of for a blessing. And what I mean by that, in Genesis 1, God made the man. Then he blessed him. Then he said, go to work. And ever since the fall, we've done it the other way around. I am going to go to work and hope I get a blessing. I believe most of us, at some level, who are in ministry, struggle with being people pleasers. If we didn't like people, we wouldn't have done this in the first place. And I don't have to tell you, you will never win the people-pleasing game. You just won't. And when I first started preaching, they had to actually sit down and write you a letter to let you know what they thought of you. Now they just have to click a couple of things, and they can do it. And I have learned, if I, every single week, depend on feedback from whom I pleased to keep doing this, I'm not going to last. And so it's easier to say than do, but I try to live out of the sense. I am a blessed man of God. God has blessed me. He's anointed me with a gift. He's given me a place and a people to use that gift. And I've got to live out of that blessing and hear His well done. Instead of deciding on whether or not you're going to give me your blessing to feel good about what I'm doing. It's the most important thing I think I've learned. It's something I have to live and relearn every single day and every single week. I am never going to win the people-pleasing game. I have got to operate out of my blessing instead of work for it. There you go.
Yeah, I want to join in on that. That I, because of inferiority, I just worked myself into a frenzy trying to keep everyone happy. I thought I could get it done. And the biggest mistake that I made is betraying God by trying to please the powerful in the congregation. And another mistake I made was patting myself on the back egotistically in that I had pleased them. And that just was, that's not a good thing. And again, that's that throwing the notes away sort of. You have to cut it off and be out there and go, God, if you're not there, it just isn't going to fly. And it's amazing how the things that you fear, the more that you clip it and move away from the things you fear, knowing you're going to catch it. God is there. I thought about on five different occasions at Memorial that they would fire me the next day. Or maybe not wait till the next day. I did a sermon one time, the flock is sick because it's not being shepherded. And I knew then, we're either going to have all our... I hadn't thought that sounded funny, really, but I knew then we'll either have eight elders come forward tonight or I'll be going out. I mean, it was that deal. And I would call Dusty and his mom and Mary and his brother and sister in. How many times, Dusty, did we do that, three or four on a Saturday night, and say, I am so sorry, but I think we're going to be leaving your friends tomorrow. I just didn't know this was such a comedy. it was really hard, guys, but what Rick's saying, it really, really matters. And it was just shocking to me that God would be there all the time. Okay, my next one. What was my next one? Oh, yeah, listen to this. Don't be looking at that.
There you go. Yes.
This is a thing that I poo-pooed for years, and that is to learn to listen for God. I didn't know a relationship with God meant two ways. I thought He had finalized all of His communication here, and now then I will learn from this and go there. But there was no hearing from Him, and we mocked anybody that did. I mocked anybody that said they did. Heard from God. I want you to know, I think the Bible says that we hear from God. In James chapter 3, in James 1 he says, if you lack wisdom, ask Him. In James 3, he says He will send it in from heaven. Well, now, how's He going to send it in? Here? Well, if here, then why ask for it up there Why not just read it out of here? So I need to know, God, do you want me to live in Quincy, Illinois, or move to Tulsa, Oklahoma? Well, let's see. Look under Quincy. It just isn't there. So I'm going to tell you this, that I will never finish a sermon until it's over. I used to have it all done by Saturday night, then maybe by Sunday morning, but I will stay. He will sometimes say things to me in songs that Shane will lead. He will say things to me through a visitor that walked in tears. He will say things to me just me being by myself. The most times that he will say things to me is when I wake up of a morning and I don't even know I'm me yet. You know that moment right there where you're awake and you don't know you're you? And he will start. And I'm telling you, all I can say to you is it's not English words. It is an awareness. He causes things to occur to me. I become aware of this possibility and this idea. And it was about 10 days ago that I was working on something, and I woke up, and I mean, tears are just going down the side of my face while I'm laying there on the pillow. I haven't said a thing or thought a thing, and he just brings it in, and it mapped out an idea, an approach in the Word that I hadn't seen yet, and it was what I was working on. And people will say to me on Wednesday or Saturday, how's your sermon going? And I will say, it's right on schedule. Because God has it going. But I saw this in just this week in Isaiah 50, verse 4. The Lord has given me the tongue of disciples that I may know how to sustain the weary one with the word. He awakens me morning by morning. He awakens my ear to listen as a disciple. Now, I have to tell you, in my old days, I mocked anybody that thought that was right. First of all, I could say, well, that's Old Testament. But the more that we walk with God and walk open with God, the more he communicates to us. And I get my sermon ideas from just watching life, not just going here to find 3 points and a close. I just listen and notice what's going on in the world. And often I'll be watching something on TV. It can be American Idol. It can be Biggest Loser. It can be a movie. And all of a sudden, there it is. And it's something that pertains to us. And so I go, look, and there it is. So,
well, I'm going to piggyback on that and then go to my next one. If you know Terry, you know that his one of the things we admire most about him is his intimacy with God is not fake. I felt like the Lord impressed upon me something here just recently. In Exodus 34, there, you know the story. The people have sinned. Moses is pleading. And God says this to them. He says, you know what? Just go. Take them. Go to the promised land. I ain't going. And Moses said, well, then I'm not going. I don't want it if you're not there. And here's what I felt like the Lord was saying to me. All right, Rick, if I could give you your desired future, your church looked everything like you wanted to look, and your family was everything you wanted to be, but you didn't have intimacy with me, would you take it? And I really got convicted about that. Because I'm in some stuff right now, like all of you are, that I really wish would go away. But it is drawing me, it's pressing me closer to God. And so I think what I hear Terry saying to me is, if I am going to lead my people to the future I want for them, I've got to stay intimate with God, talking, listening, hearing. It is possible for us to go after the future that we so desperately want. And get there, and God's not there with us. You know, the fact of the matter is, you can be a pretty dang successful preacher and a pretty unspiritual person. So that's what I hear. All right, now here's the second thing. I could take 50 minutes on this. I'm gonna try to be through in 4 or 5. I wish I didn't have to make this point, but I do. It takes more than good preaching to build a church. Mm-hmm. It takes good leading. I did not know that for years. When I left ACU, I thought if I would just write good sermons and live a life of integrity, the church will grow. And I was wrong. The church will be happy. The church will pat you on the back and give you a small raise every year. If you will just preach good sermons and live a life of integrity, but the church will not grow. It will not grow until it's led. And here's the thing. Sheep will never come to a shepherd and say, "Would you take us to another pasture?" They will stay where they are till the grass is gone and the water's dirty. But they will never, it is the shepherd's job to say, "We're here now, but we better get there. If we stay here, we'll become unhealthy." That's leading. Now, do you lead through preaching? Absolutely. You lead through preaching. But simply writing good sermons and being a good person will not grow your church. And that's reality. Part of the frustration I bet a lot of us feel in our fellowship is this. Our polity doesn't promote good leading. And it's not because anybody's bad. Years ago, I was at a seminar with ministers from different religious groups. And the leader of the seminar was a guy named Lyle Schaller, who 20 years ago was the church guru of the day. And he'd written a book called The Senior Pastor. Well, it was a good book, but didn't bless me any. There were three or four of us from Churches of Christ there. And so we got to have an audience with him later and said, "Dr. Schaller, great book, but we're not senior pastors, okay? I can't have a song sung during communion unless I get the elders to approve it first. I don't decide any of this stuff you're talking about." He said to me, he said, "Churches of Christ," he said, "I know you guys." And then he said this, he said, "You crank out some of the greatest preachers in the country." That's what he said. He said, "You guys can flat preach, but your churches stagnate. They go to so far and they plateau and they stop." And he said, "Here's why. Your churches are led by a board," that's what he called it, "you call elders. They're good guys. They're godly men. Most of them are overworked. They got big jobs. They're busy. They're not, so what's their number one value? Their number one value is peace. The last thing they want is that phone call at 10 o'clock Sunday night. You know what happened at church today?" And so, without even knowing it, the number one value of most elderships, if number one value is peace, the number one goal is status quo. Now think through me. If people couldn't stand status quo, they wouldn't be there. So, our polity is set up for church to just kind of stay where it is. Because the peace isn't disturbed. Here's the problem. That's not how you run an army. That's how you run a hospice. Now, how many churches are really well-run, sweet places for really sweet people to die? And so we're frustrated because we are often judged by our fruitfulness, by is the church growing? But we've got a system designed to keep bold leadership from taking place. So I don't know all the answer to that. I have some thoughts, but that's not where we're going right now. Well, all I'm saying to you right now, as you work with your elders, if you have elders, as you work with your staff, if you have staff, as you look at your own place in your church as the primary voice of your church, just know this. Simply writing good sermons and living a life of integrity will not take your church to a new place. Your people will be content, but your church will stagnate. Because it takes more than good preaching. It takes good leading, however that happens. Now, have I sufficiently depressed everybody? So, fix it. Go ahead.
Let me fix what Rick has just botched so badly. He caused me to think of some experiences at Memorial with elderships, and so let's talk about that a little bit because it's very pertinent. He just brought out a very major, stunning thing, I think. When I moved to Memorial, they had just fired the preacher in front of me, And I was 29 years old, and I was the perfect guy to go in there because I was so stupid. I was so green. I hadn't been converted long, and I was a mess. I mean to tell you, I may have thought I was coming to town to really solve things, but I just fit right in. And but the eldership was very, very controlling. And people would say to me, in those very early months, how are you doing with the elders? And I would say back, which elders? The ones I have now or the ones I have 15 years from now? Because the ones I have now, I'm getting along with them just fine. But wait till you see who we have 15 years from now. Now, I never disobeyed one elder's command. I never did. I never went in the pulpit with anything that I didn't like about it, because they were over me, and I knew it. I would have it out with them in the room by myself, and it got tough because I was green and inferior and ignorant. But I never would go to the pulpit and point out some decision they made that didn't fly. But I knew God was going to help us with our eldership. And after 7 years, one of the deacons called me and said, Terry, we're having a meeting off at a campsite with all of the deacons and all of the elders, and we want you there. We're asking the elders to step down. And I just could I'd never heard of such a thing in all of my life. And I kept quiet about it. I didn't boast about it. I didn't fret about it. It wasn't my role. God was doing the thing that he could do. Now, I got to tell you, they stepped down with a fight, and it was a great injury and great struggle, and it continued for years. And we put in two succeeding elderships that were just as difficult. And by God's grace, somewhere along the line, about the 20th year that I was there, he changed it. And, I mean, it was hard, but here's the thing for us. If any of you live in that zone, here's the thing for us. That God is always training his disciples in the center of great stress and pain. Don't waste it. Don't waste it by fretting it and trying to get it to go away. Learn while it's there, because you see, I needed rough decisions. I needed tough decisions. I even needed wrong decisions to train me to look. Don't bolt and run, because I'm so frail in my disposition that I'm the kind that would scat in a hurry. I mean, it's amazing that he would help me do it. So I want to encourage you that Rick just said some things that I tell you would cause alarm nearly everywhere we are, because it's the truth that our main goal is peace. And yesterday afternoon in the class I had, I talked about that one of the great traits of leadership is that we let congregations be pruned. Our elders quit chasing the people that wanted to go. They quit. They said, the elders said, when we got to about year 20 or 21, the new eldership said, look, if they're wanting to leave us, we do not want to interfere with the call of God. And they would bless them and they would let them go. And something changed when they did that. And so I'm not speaking at all against elders. I have never gone contrary to what any of my elderships said. I've always kept it private in the meeting with them over whatever it was personally. And I have had a lot and have a lot coming that I've got to grow up in. And I'll tell you what, that doesn't bug me, because I used to think that I'm about a junior in kingdom, and one day I'll be a senior in kingdom. I really believe now I'm in kindergarten with no hopes of ever making it to first grade, and don't want to be. Don't want to get to first grade. I love being in the child role with God.
That's a good word. I get this phone call a lot. I don't know why, but I get it a lot from preachers, young and old, saying, here's my situation. I'm so frustrated. Should I leave? And, of course, you can't answer that question after someone's giving you a 5-minute description of a church with a 50-year history. But here's what I often respond. I said, who are your next generation of elders? Because if you see great hope there, you need to stay. And he said, well, I don't know, because elderships do tend to perpetuate themselves. But some of that is our fault. What are we doing to mentor the next generation of elders? What are you doing right now? Who have you targeted, and where are you being intentional? Right now at our church, every elder and every minister has three young men in the 25 to 40 range we're personally intentionally mentoring, so that 15 years from now, we got some incredible elders to be coming along. That we're not just going to hope they're there. We're going to know they're there because we're getting them ready now. So I think that is really important. But what you said is, I think, so crucial and so hard. Can you trust God enough? And can you live in faith enough that letting people go is okay? I will tell you, at our church, there was something that happened before I came. So it happened 30 years ago. It is probably the single one thing that has blessed our church more than ever. Believe it or not, this is back in the 70s, and the issue of the day was coffee and donuts in the classroom. And some sister came to one of our elders, and she was upset because there was coffee and donuts in the classroom. Now, historically, how do we do? Well, okay, you know what? I'm sorry you're upset. I will bring it up at the next elders meeting. It's on the agenda. We got some upset about coffee and donuts. What are we going to do? So after a long discussion that usually takes several weeks, it's decided, in order to keep the peace, let's just cut out coffee and donuts. This elder, his name is Don McCann, he's with the Lord now. He put his arm around that lady. He said, okay, here's the deal. With a 10-mile radius of this church, there's 20 places you can go next week that don't have coffee and donuts, if that's really important to your faith. But if you come back here next Sunday, you come back happy, and you don't bring us up ever again, that's your choice. Now, since then, there have been a dozen critical meetings where we find ourselves drifting toward a fear-based decision to placate, when somebody will say, brothers, coffee and donuts, and we get called back to our best selves. And we remember, we cannot lead by allowing people to threaten us. Now, that's easier to say than to do, but I will tell you, if I could pick one thing about my elders that I think has blessed our church more than any other, it is they consciously try to lead by mission instead of by fear. And here's the thing. We can help them here. We can constantly speak into them faith in God. We can constantly call out fear. Here's what we often do instead. We get angry and we jump up in the pulpit and we preach against fear. And we think we're going to motivate or embarrass or move our elders by preaching at them in the pulpit. And that's not going to happen.
That's right.
One other thing I've got on here I've learned. People don't hear anger. No matter how right you are, they don't hear anger. And so I do constantly, with teaching times with my elders and with retreats and with just personal conversations and lunches, we talk about the fear demon. We address it. We identify it. But I don't try to shake my elders by preaching at them in front of the church.
And he makes me think of, and I think it's my turn next whenever we get.
Okay.
Yeah, but I'm going to put an appendage to your, whatever that would be, to appendix. I need you to know something that I didn't think for a long, long time, and probably it broke about year 20. I really thought, even though we say we have elders and everything, I want to tell you, I thought I was the main guy. I thought I was the main guy. I'm the guy that's studying a lot and out there making the visits and all that stuff. And so I approached whatever we did as if I were the main guy, and we sort of honorarily let these guys be the shepherds, but we all knew. And I did do what the elders suggested and insisted, but that I was the main guy. Here's what I know now. I know now. The weakest link at Memorial Drive, factually, is me. Not nice to say it. That's a humble way to do it. Factually, the weakest link at Memorial is me. The weakest link on our staff of five men is me. And I tell them that. I talk with those guys every day. I love them. And I talk to them every day, and I will tell them, look, you guys, you're doing a great job. You've got the weak link here. They don't believe me. They think that I'm just saying that to encourage them. When you take a look at this, and you look what he needs, and what he is not getting out of me, there is no one else weaker. Here's a passage that I don't like that says, therefore, it's Romans 2:1. Therefore, you are without excuse, every man of you who passes judgment. For in that you judge another, you condemn yourself, for you who judge practice the same things. And if I'm getting irritated with any cluster or any individual, there's something I already know about the story. Is that whatever it is I'm critical of in my judgment, I'm guilty of it. That's how I caught it and recognized it. That's what he says. And we know that the judgment of God rightly falls upon those who practice such things. Oh, do you suppose this, old man? Do you suppose this, old Terry, when you pass judgment upon those who practice such things and do the same yourself, that you will escape the judgment of God? And what I'd want to say is, I didn't do exactly what they did. But when you get to thinking about it, no, it was just identical to what they did. You just had a little sweeter stab with the dagger than they had with their harshness or whatever. And it really has gotten to me and made me ashamed of things that I've said in the past. And I used to be a pulpit pounder yeller. And may I say, proud of it. In Kirksville, Missouri, I was a guest preacher on two different occasions, broke that pulpit two times, and was proud of it. I mean, I know there's some preaching, and there wasn't some preaching. There was some pounding and yelling, and this annoying little woman at Memorial Drive just kept saying to me, Terry, you're just so mean. Huh? And I would go away going, she's so yellow. And she'd say, Terry, you're just so mean. And I'd go, she is just such a coward. She didn't understand you. And she was right. I was just an ego trip parading. And that helped no one. I loved it when our people brought visitors so I could just ream them out for being Baptist and Methodist. And I mean, and I'd watch their eyeballs go, you know, and I just, that means I'm on. And then I realized, why would anybody bring a visitor to hear me preach? And it broke my heart. Because they shouldn't ever bring a visitor. So I guarantee you this right now. There is not a Sunday that I preach, not a time that I preach, that every visitor walked in, walked out with great hope. That's what I want them to know. So, you want to add anything to that adage? Okay. About the message of hope, here's what I discovered. My job, I'm not a real preacher, I don't think, I love what Mark said, if I can find it here in a hurry. I want to see just exactly how he's worded it, because we like to use it as, and he said, and he did not let him, but he said to him, go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you and how he had mercy on you. My job is I want to report the things I've seen God do. I want you to know it. I want everybody to know I saw God do these things. Let me tell you why it's so exciting to me. I was trained in school that all of the good stuff had ceased. It had quit. Now, I never suspected that that wasn't right. I was geared up to make sure that stays strong and I never yield. But so, when I begin to realize God is working, He's working, and right now, while we're in here, can you imagine the souls that are being baptized in Mexico and in Brazil and in Afghanistan, in the Red Sea, in Libya? Can you imagine the working of God going on that you had direct influence in through some training? Can you think of money you gave to a mission cause 7 years ago? You don't even know where you were 7 days ago. And you gave money 7 years ago and helped a person. It's exploding in productivity. That's what I want to tell our people about. That's it.
Well, you know what? I'm going to kind of jump on that a little bit. I'm going to put two things together. I wrote down here. One was, our people will respond if we will provide what I call the next doable step. I think too often in our preaching, we preach a message on a principle that no one's going to disagree with. We should pray more for the lost. Nobody's going to shake their head like this. But no one's going to pray more for the lost either. And they're just going to feel guilty. I don't do that enough. What I learned is if I preach that message and I say, outside, there's a board. And by that board, there's a time for you. And around the clock for the next 30 days, we're going to pray for the lost. And I want you to sign up for 30 minutes. And as a church, for 1 month, we're praying for the lost. They will do that. They will feel good that they do that. They will learn something. They will practice what you preach. And you don't really learn it until you practice what you've heard. There's something about being a doer of the word, not just a hearer. But you say, I realized a long time ago, I accepted ownership. It's my fault. I'm always telling my people to do something and not providing a vehicle to do it. Who's going to disagree with a sermon that the kingdom of God should love children? But how are they going to react to that? What camp can they start supporting? What website do you have set up where they can go to and they can adopt a kid? Give your people next doable steps. And then the second thing related to it, I've learned this value is celebrate wins. Mm-hmm. And celebrate wins. Let them know you're making a difference. We're doing something. This city, this community, the world is a better place because we exist. Mm-hmm. We're doing something. You know, probably almost all of our churches a year ago took up a special collection for Haiti. How many churches told their people later what happened to that money? You know, I made a point on two different Sundays to show slides. You see those tents? You bought those tents. You see those medical supplies? They were purchased with your offering. You see that spot of land now where that school's going up? We bought that land. Now, the next time I need to have a special contribution for an emergency, I think the potential of them responding is going to be much greater because I gave them a next doable step and I celebrated the win. And I think that's part of just what good leadership's about. Mm-hmm. So I would encourage you as you teach your church and as you preach, what avenue am I trying to provide where people can leave and say, instead of, I feel guilty, I'm not doing that enough. And he said, I signed up to do something like that. Something that we can talk about later and celebrate.
Yeah, that really changed for us at Memorial because I changed. But I try to, as I get into the morning on my time, I try to point out something somebody has done. Hey, did you all hear about this family and what they did? Did you? And you keep, you know, our church used to talk about the things that were going wrong, and it was the constant breeze coming through. We had days where, I don't know if you were this way, but every Sunday when something went on during the assembly that wasn't scheduled, all of us went, I wonder how we're going to get a phone call on this, you know, just really nervous. But it isn't that way anymore because we are constant. We have too much awe to talk about. It's just we can't report it all. Rick, I'm going to move away just a little bit and ask you something here. And if you look at me and say, I don't know right now, fine, because this wasn't rehearsed. We look at you and we go, man, you know things that we just don't even think of. We may be covering a few of them here. If you were to move into Memorial Drive or any of our places, what do you think that you would see to go, look, here's where we're going to go to work right away? Does anything hit you immediately? And if not, I'll move on.
You think more highly of me than you ought. First place, I don't think I would come to any of your churches and try to fix anything immediately. Just like, I don't mean this pompously, none of you could come to my congregation and be as effective as I am right now. I mean, you could in time. But I've earned the right to speak into that church. I know that church. And so I tell you something else I've learned. Credibility doesn't transfer. Have you ever noticed that? I don't care how much you thought you learned at this one church. You go to the next, it doesn't transfer.
That's right.
But here is one thing that I think I would do if I came to any of your churches. I think I have learned this. that you have to ground a church in the grace and the mission of God before you try to change anything. And if I know some of you, if I followed some of you, I could say, I know this church. This church is steeped in the grace of God and the mission of God. I won't have to wait long here to change something. But if I didn't know, I wouldn't assume. One of the reasons, still, even though we've been coming to Tulsa for 30 years, our churches get so tense when change is proposed, is because in the minds of so many of our members, that tape is still playing. That how I do church affects how I relate to God. And as long as that tape is playing, change is scary. Because you're not touching methodology, even though that's what you think you're talking about. You're touching their salvation. And for so many of our people, ecclesiology is still the way they get right with God, not Christology. And so if I'm coming to a church, I'm not changing anything for a long time. I am preaching hard the cross. I am just talking week after week. Grace of God, mission of God. Grace of God, mission of God. And then maybe we would assess if something here needs to be done.
Okay, the clock is ticking, so give us your last shot that you want to take.
Well, okay, I don't even know if this is the most important, but I want to talk about this one. This is up here if you want to see it. I think I would say to all of you, do not be timid about preaching about stewardship and about discipling your high-capacity givers. I, for 10 years, had to be told by my elders to talk about stewardship because I was so concerned people would perceive me as, you're just in this for what? The offering and for what you get paid. What I understand now is that most of our people want to be more engaged in the kingdom of God. They want to be more spontaneous. Just going on a mission trip. Just adopting an orphanage. That sounds. They are so up to here in debt, they can't respond. And we have got to talk about it. It is the number one, I think, bondage in our churches.
That's right.
It is the number one bondage in our churches. And it's my job as teaching pastor to help people find deliverance. I'm not talking about offerings, guys. I'm not talking about giving. I'm talking about freedom from the idol of money and teaching what Jesus taught. 1/6 of all of Jesus' statements, 1/3 of all of Jesus' parables was on money. He talked about money more than anything else except the kingdom of God. In the first 10 years of my preaching, I didn't talk about it at all. So I wasn't preaching like Jesus. So I just would say to you that you've got to be intentional teaching, attacking this idol. Our people think their self-worth and their net worth are connected. And it's a blazing lie. It's an idol. It's got to be. And I would say to you also, I think you got to be intentional discipling your high-capacity givers. Because our churches have people that can tithe every week. And what they could be doing for the kingdom of God is not touched. And someone's got to be dreaming huge things with them, talking big dreams with them, and discipling those guys. God has given them resources for more than just a tithe and a really fancy cruise with the family this summer.
I wanted to share something with you, and I am kind of afraid to. And I had decided I wouldn't until he just said what he just said. I wanted to because I really want to. But I'm afraid of how it comes out. So I'm going to tell you that. And then I think I'll tell you. What we have to have in our work is grace, the grace of God. I'm not talking about in the line of being saved. I'm talking about His power to get the work done. We have to have it. Whether whatever we're doing, parenting, ministry, organization, we have to have it. So we move in ways that says that he brings the grace in. One of those ways is in giving. Not the church's giving, in your giving and in mine. This is what the word says. I say this, he who sows sparingly shall also reap sparingly, and he who sows bountifully shall also reap bountifully. Let each one do just as he has purposed in his heart, not grudgingly or under compulsion, for God loves a cheerful giver. And God is able to make all grace abound to you, that always having all sufficiency in everything, you may have an abundance for every good deed. I'm going to tell you this because if Marvin Phillips hadn't have told me, I don't think I would have ever learned it. And I talked to him about it yesterday. We were on a plane in the late 70s, headed to a workshop out east. We were sitting side by side, and he had his Bible open, and we were studying. I was studying my stuff, trays down, and he leaned over, and he said this, what I thought was a terribly bold statement. He said, Russian, I've got my giving up to $100 a week. I never knew anyone gave $100 a week, ever. That never. I was at 20. I'd moved up from 17. And I've never forgotten where he was and where I was. That changed my world. We didn't get a raise at Memorial for 3 years after I learned that lesson. We had three kids who were wanting more food. And you know how when they're little you take them and you split a McDonald's hamburger three ways and then they get to where they each want two of their own? That's how we were doing. And the elders after 3 years called me and they said, Terry, we're giving you a raise. And it was a big raise. It was $30 a week. 30 a week. And Mary and I raised our contribution 35 a week to watch God. To watch God. And it started us, and I want to tell you, I've cleared the 600 mark per week, and I want to keep going. I want to one day be able to give $1,000 a week out of my check. Now, that scares me to tell you, for fear God wouldn't like that. And I'm pleading with you, please don't take that wrong. I'm meaning the same spirit Marvin said it to me. I never had that thought. And I was the type that if I could have let him have it and go on and go, that just doesn't apply to me. It does apply to me. This applies to us. And we need the power, and we need the power of God. And one of the ways that he releases it is when he sees us take what we really need, we count it on, and we give it to him so that he can do his stuff. Y'all, we sent three kids through Christian colleges and came out at the end and didn't owe any money. And it was amazing. We had one payment where we didn't know how we were going to pay it. And a lady hit my wife in the intersection and totaled out the car. And the settlement was just exactly what Harvard had.
Praise the Lord.
And I'm just so glad that he used Mary. Okay, guys, thank you. Please take all of that carefully. Please, please, please. And thank you for being good to Rick and me.